Hello and welcome to the Green Room at Furnitubes. I'm your host, Catherine Barrett, and we're here every month with a new episode. Join us for industry musings, interviews and discussions exploring all things landscape architecture, street furniture and urban design.
Hi, so in our latest instalment of Your View From Here in the Green Room podcast, we have Maria Gutierrez, landscape architect at Gillespie's. As a product designer, Maria shares her journey as product designer in Colombia to becoming a landscape architect in the UK and how she's built on her skill set along the journey. We touch on the different perspectives she brings to projects, and she shares her insights from both professions and some of her favourite projects. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Catherine.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming in. So it'd be great if we could start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself and your journey from Colombia to the UK via product design and landscape architecture.
Yeah, sure. I'm from Bogota. That's the capital city of Colombia.
Vibrant.
Very busy, dominated by asphalt cars. And the city I remember was not necessarily the one that had this priority for public space and this kind of thing. So, yeah, it was a nice place to grow up in.
Yes.
But you always have these wishes, like, how can cities be nicer and better for people? Back then, yeah, I was too young to find a way or learn the specific skills that could possibly be helpful in those transformations. But I do remember having, like, for instance, this experience with my schoolmates, that one of them had a country house where we go on the weekends. And suddenly from this contrasting environment that I was living in, we were completely exposed to nature. So that developed a very strong sense of respect and appreciation for the things we didn't have in the city. Despite that appreciation and fascination for nature, I had never heard about landscape architecture before.
Right.
That didn't happen after many years. But I knew I wanted to do something related to design.
Yes.
And I ended up chosen product design.
And you studied that in Bogota?
I studied that in Bogota, like 5 years. So in my last year, I was very lucky that my university organized like a sort of international program.
Right.
And that was my chance to come to Europe and kind of see what was going on and what others were doing. But we had modules in Paris, in Barcelona. So it was really being exposed to different cultures, places, things that brought other interests to product design.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a very interesting exchange with architects, artists, and people from different professions.
Yes.
So that was also like another dimension, like how we can start collaborating and bring like a different meaning and value to what we do, not just...
So that feeling of not being in a silo.
Exactly.
Yes.
That was also the chance for me to hear about landscape architecture.
Yes.
It was just when I came and started my internships. Yeah. I did one in Milan and one in Barcelona. And finally, my very first job as a product designer was for a landscape studio.
Really?
Yeah.
Right.
So that's how it all started. I began designing urban furniture for landscape projects. Eventually, I got involved into the projects. I started doing all the scale models for landscape architecture projects. And that gave me an understanding of what landscape architecture is capable of.
Yes.
Now, like, because they were involved in different scales, like from private gardens to master planning, also like a public realm. So it was suddenly like a whole dimension,
a
huge world.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel like a foreigner. No, it was like a different dimension of design.
That makes sense. And so we've talked before, it's not really that you switched from product design to landscape architecture, it's that you added landscape architecture to your kind of creative skill set or your problem-solving skill set, I guess. So how did you go about then saying, right, well, I'm really interested in landscape architecture, I would like to add that as a qualification?
Well, it was after a couple of years of being working for landscape studios that I was always like being the product designer doing landscape things. And then I said, well, I could probably just get a proper qualification and that would actually give me the confidence to get immersed fully in landscape without leaving product design.
Without forgetting product design.
Because I always bring it back. Like it depends on the scale I'm working on. So probably I don't touch it in conceptual designs for landscape, but as the project evolves, there's always the point where product design comes in.
And how does it help you, or how does it influence you at those kind of as you've got further along in the stages? Is it how you're thinking about people will use the space? Is it kind of a people-centric type approach?
Absolutely. I would say one of the concerns of product design is this relationship between the user and the product. So we have this always in mind, this intimate relationship between one and the other, how things can create memories or how you can influence the emotional, psychological or physical aspects of a person through an object.
Yes.
So all these kind of things obviously play a very important role when you think about in a space or a product within a wider context, in this case, like outdoor spaces.
And how, I guess, people also like to feel space around them, so how they want to sit or how groups of people want to sit and what feeling that produces as well. Having that knowledge, you're already understanding how people use product and use space.
Yeah, I think it goes back and forth all the time. Like sometimes I can think about, let's say, a bench, but then it is because of landscape architecture that I'm able to imagine 10 benches in a park.
Yes, whereas as a product designer, you're thinking about potentially a bench.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah.
So to me, that's the fascinating thing, is to jump between the scales, going back and forth and imagine, okay, well, we designed this, but who's going to use this and how?
Yep.
So that's the interesting point or the interesting aspect for me to kind of navigate with the user, but also being able to see a holistic way of those objects or relationships also, because sometimes you create or encourage, like, let's say, social interaction through specific objects. So that's also another fascinating aspect of product design, for instance, in this context.
In this context. And so what does good landscape architecture mean to you? How would you kind of describe it or visualize it?
Rather depends on a very specific time, place, culture, geography.
Right.
So things that work pretty well in the UK or Europe might not necessarily be an ultimate solution in South America.
Right.
So I would say that, there's not really like good and bad in this. It's just how you contextualize your work and how you respond specifically to the site, to the brief, to a specific group of people.
Yeah.
And without bringing like examples from far away and they don't necessarily apply, but rather finding this uniqueness, this unique character of a place and how that helps to that specific community or whoever you're designing
for. So it's understanding the soul of a place and the community and how to respond to it.
From my point of view, that would be probably a mistake, not to try to force like brilliant ideas that have succeeded in other places and try to adapt that to a context that is not or doesn't offer the same conditions or same circumstances.
Yes. And you've lived in, as you say, you've lived in some really great cities, and obviously Bogota has a history of urbanism. Were you living there at that point when there was the transition to transform Bogota, or was that after you'd left?
Most significant or obvious changes happened when I was still there. But let's say that it was a series of long transitions. It took at least 10, 15 years to go through a series of transitions in terms of urbanism and landscape, or like as a whole, the master plan that was implemented to have the city, or to have the city that we have today.
Yes.
So it took a long time. I witnessed some of the changes when I was there, still far from perfect, but
right.
I do remember from the city that is in my mind when I was a child to the city that I left, there's a huge gap.
Right.
Obviously, we still need to work on many aspects. There are many things that need to be fixed at a social level, political, financial. But those changes gave us a little bit of hope of what of a different vision of what it could be. Exactly. Yep. So that's the important thing. So at least they started.
Yes.
Even it doesn't matter if it wasn't perfect, but they just started and just gave laid out a foundation for others to take.
And the commitment.
And the commitment, exactly.
Bogota is often cited as a really interesting improvement or regeneration in a city. What do you think was specific about the approach to master planning that's really interesting, and how much of it do you remember, and how much of it did you kind of do you look back and appreciate now?
Well, now they have a little bit more of notion about master planning, landscape and all these kind of things. I definitely appreciate many things about the master plan in Bogota. I would say the origin itself, before even creating a master plan, we had to sort of understand what we had to work with. So let's say that before all the green spaces, parks, reservoirs, or even pocket parks were considered or were mapped as green spaces.
Right.
And not all of them were mapped. So we had to understand all the resources that we had and come up with a categorization.
Right.
To try to understand the network of green spaces and
the
how
existing green
the
spaces.
Existing green spaces
right.
to understand how they were connected to each other and how they were able to support the city's infrastructure and so on. So that was probably the first stage. So we didn't even know what we had. And then, especially if you think like, okay, this has to be driven by nature, but we don't know where it is and or what forms it's got. Like, is it a river or is it a reservoir? Many different...
The documenting of the baseline of where you were starting from.
The very basic.
Yeah.
Just to map out and come up with a categorization to name things as they should. No, like if you look at the UK, like you have a very clear categorization of a regional park, metropolitan, a pocket park, and then that relates to a very specific or a range of area.
Yeah,
we didn't have that before. If you don't have that, you cannot understand what you have.
Yeah. And how you what you're starting with, what you can do, what you can improve.
Exactly. Yeah. And how we can overlap like all the layers of complexity, not transport, cycle lanes, pedestrian areas. So that was the base and one of the most important steps to be able to bring a coherent master plan. Then obviously, there has to be a very important leadership, political will. So it's got to be a combination of everything. Also, a group of experts. All these meaningful collaborations, like you just bring the people with the right expertise.
Yeah.
This is not possible with one person or just one idea. It has
but
to
they
be
need
many.
To be unified by one vision,
exactly,
right? So you want all the experts in going in the same direction, and that requires really strong leadership.
Yeah, absolutely.
With political will.
Yeah, with political will. So I would say, yeah, I remember at least 2 or 3 administrations, very specific people that intervene and kind of prepare the way for that. So one, they all have very different backgrounds.
Right.
So that was also interesting. One had a background in philosophy.
Right.
So he was pretty much doing civic campaigns, like
right.
educational campaigns
right.
to prepare people for change.
Right. So that was that was the first piece.
That was the first
piece. So you
piece.
Needed that first philosophical, educational piece to get the mindset.
Exactly. Oh, so yeah. to get the mindset, yeah. that was probably the first step
yeah.
to see or to imagine, okay, we need to respect traffic signs.
Right.
We need to respect pedestrians. it sounds ridiculous,
but
it was
know
it was
place.
That way.
Yeah,
I remember back then it was like that.
Yeah.
It's just we didn't have bus stops.
Right.
So people would just stop with yeah. the handout. And if you can imagine, I mean, we are 10 million people.
Right.
And then in one block, you could have like
six times
yeah. easily.
Right.
So it will take you ages to go from point A to B.
Yes.
This kind of mindset change was probably one of the first steps towards like a more friendly city.
Right.
And then also that person I remember visualized also the need to save the financial means so that he or the next person could execute physical change.
Reserving a budget.
Reserving
a
budget to be able to transform the city physically.
Yeah.
So it was not just about the people anymore, but the next administration would most likely, obviously, need the financial means to transform the city physically.
Yeah.
So the next one did that, executed many of those projects. But as you said, the leadership of the master plan probably happened in that era.
Right.
So it was really the idea or the vision to organize the city based on the natural resources.
Yep.
So how can we bring all these layers of complexity of a city, like as I mentioned before, like transport, schools, parks, cycle lanes, all these kind of things together,
mm-hmm.
having in mind that we have to connect those to the green network of a city. So that was probably one of the best approaches that they could have back then. Obviously, nowadays we say, oh, wow, they could have done this or that. Of course, I mean.
But now we've got the benefit of
exactly,
looking back.
And there was no precedent of something similar in the city.
Yep.
So probably we had like other examples, transport systems in Brazil or other examples in other places in Latin America. But we didn't have our own precedent project. So it was a great experiment. It's still in progress, I'd say. It's not a perfect city. But from what I remember until now, I mean, there are many things to criticize always in all the cities, but I think we have improved in many different ways, and we just need to be conscious about where we can keep on improving.
Yeah. And what are the measures of improvement? Because, I mean, to me, it already springs to mind, it's people's quality of life, there's the quality of the environment, there's sort of biodiversity, there's the economic success, the impact. So there's so many impacts. Do you think it's measured or is it a feeling?
It could be a combination of both.
Mm.
I mean, obviously I compare or assess those changes based on what I remember. That's my own way of measuring. Like, okay, well, we didn't have bus stops before. But if you ask probably a citizen now.
Yes, does their life feel better?
Probably not necessarily. And say, well, probably she's crazy because she's not living here in Bogota. So it's very relative. But I would say, I mean, and I still go and I cycle, I drive, I try to experience the city in different ways. Yes. I could walk like 4 hours,
yeah,
enjoy the city. And I could see from the Bogota, I remember, I can see many changes.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, I don't think that's the same perception,
right,
that especially young people that they have today, because this is the only one they've known.
The only thing they know.
This is the only city they've known.
Yes.
And obviously, it's not perfect.
Right.
So, but from my perspective, I remember the before and after, and then I can point out and highlight and appreciate things that have changed for good.
Yeah.
But I'm very much aware that things might not necessarily be the same for people living at the moment in Bogota.
But it also has to be remembered that at the time it was considered so groundbreaking. I think it influenced a number of other cities as well. So it's not just the impact it had itself,
yeah,
but also that it showed other cities what could be done. It gave not necessarily the take the same thing and put it somewhere else, or that might have been done, but actually just that inspiration that actually we can do this. So I think it was inspiring for quite a few cities. How would you now, if someone asked you to design a bench, how would you approach it now versus, say, at the beginning of your career without having the background of landscape architecture? You mentioned before 1 versus 10. How would you think about a product now with understanding how it might be used more in context?
Well, I would probably start by asking myself if we truly need the bench.
Right.
Sometimes we just focus on desires.
Things.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. Especially in a time where we have an enormous pressure for,
yes,
environmental,
yes,
issues.
Yep.
I think now I approach that from this conscious of like how this can improve or bring more value to this scheme.
So what problem do we think it's trying to solve? And
exactly,
is there another way of solving it?
Exactly. Yeah. So rather than thinking about desires, mm-hmm, or these kind of things, is more like the need, mm-hmm, of something. So more than ever, like in the same way, we question ourselves like, okay, do we need more buildings or we need more green spaces?
Right.
It's exactly the same, yeah, dynamic or the same question. Like, obviously, especially after COVID, like the need for open spaces where people can breathe, socialize, or even the layout of buildings need to get adapted,
mm-hmm,
and needs to change according to what we're living.
Yes.
So in the same way, like a product design needs to respond to those needs in the first place.
Yep.
And then, yeah, if it's nice, if it's cool. But first, I would say like if we need it, so we take it from there. But definitely this relationship like with nature in this case, because landscape architects work with nature as a raw design. So how can those things coexist?
Yes. Yeah, so how do you think about the nature first and how it can it coexist with the products?
Yeah, because we basically as product designers like take some resources, convert those things into objects, but then we place those objects into the environment and we don't know what's going to happen, and
right,
we should anticipate,
right,
what could happen.
Yes.
Based on that, like we could just think about like the positives and the negatives,
yep,
of bringing something foreign to,
yes,
nature,
yes,
to see how they can react.
Yep. And does it add?
Exactly.
Does it add value? I like that. I love the way that you approach the scheme and you're thinking about what's really, really necessary. What are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned? What pieces of sort of wisdom, I guess, have you taken along the way? And what are the biggest lessons you've learned so far?
I guess, yeah, when you start, obviously, you get fascinated by all the ideas of great designers and,
yeah,
how they develop a concept and those became a reality. But as I mentioned before, like this limit of adapting ideas from other context, it's a like very dangerous thing. Not like as much as we can be inspired by all the designers, all the places. It's we really need to understand the specific conditions of the place we're working and the people who are living in that space.
Yeah,
to see if that works or if we can adapt part of it or say, well, that's nice, but it doesn't work. We just need to come up with a completely different solution because that wouldn't work in Bogota or Paris or Tokyo, whatever it is.
And are there a few schemes? I'm sure there are lots, but is there a scheme that comes to mind where you think we really understood the context and we really understood what was needed and we really provided like the best solution for that specific scheme?
Yeah, there's definitely one that I really like. It's a park in central Zurich. I had the chance to work on that project with my previous office. It's called Anton Landscape Architects. Right. And it was really interesting at different levels. First of all, from an environmental point of view, like there was a challenge of working with polluted soil and how we could bring nature in a polluted site.
Would it also to then help deeper, like sort of clean the soil, or was it just to survive in the polluted soil?
So we had to look at both solutions. So what section or what part of a park were suitable for cleaning the soil? Yeah. Just go for that solution, or some others. Okay, even if we clean, we can't plant anything.
Right.
So we came up with a very interesting feature. Like it's a whole concrete embankment, which is made of recycled concrete.
Right.
It's sort of like a huge planter. And that was the only way. So we sealed the polluted soil and we were able to bring the planting on top. Mm-hmm. And it was a very interesting gesture in terms of topography, but also a way of connecting the two different levels because the park was built with very specific conditions, like the city level was 3 meters down.
Ah, so the city level was 3 meters below the sort of the top level.
Yeah,
of the park.
The lowest point of the park was actually the former city level.
Right.
But obviously, after an intense industrial activity, all the sediments and layers
of industry
exactly created a high difference of 3 meters. Mm-hmm. So it was also a response to this embankment that I'm describing. It was also a way to link those two levels, the actual city level and the original level. Yeah. It was almost like connecting history, like the original city with the new railway environment, some residential developments, hotels, and then to what it was, the city before, which was a former grassland.
Yep.
From an environmental point of view, that was really interesting to find ways where we could green up and, to be able to call it a park.
Yes.
Otherwise,
it would have been a wasteland.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Also, we didn't have any precedent of something similar built in the city. So it was a real challenge to convince the city to do something like this.
Really?
So,
why was it a challenge, do you think?
Because there was not a precedent, or something similar.
Yeah.
So it was like, do you think that could work? Or what techniques you guys would use?
Yeah.
And so there were many technical difficulties and concerns about this building, these features and all the features of a park. But basically, since they didn't know how to, we had to find a way, we could do it this way. And it was an in-situ work. So it was really interesting because we didn't really have full control of it. So it was like they had to do it on site.
What's the name of the park?
Finspalt Park.
So you're very proud of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was a good example also of female representation in landscape architecture.
Yes.
So it was very successful from all point of views, like not just the park, but in the sense of like what female in this profession can do.
Is there anything, any other projects that you've worked on that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, probably the Olympics. Yes. The Olympics here in London. I was involved in the project before even becoming a landscape architect.
Right.
And that was probably the breaking point for me. Like, okay, am I or can I pursue
right.
a landscape career or right. I'm okay as a product designer
right.
working for landscape studios? So that was probably the spark, the point where I said, well, I could probably do this or the profession. It's interesting enough for me to enroll in a master's or something like this. And that was interesting also at different levels, incredible lessons. And the team also was very diverse.
Yeah.
So I had the chance to learn about everything, like a little bit of everything,
yes,
not from
yes.
everyone. Everyone had a very different expertise, like planting, construction. And I think that's one of the beauties of this profession, the collaboration
yeah.
with different disciplines.
And the respect for so many different
exactly.
disciplines.
Exactly. Yeah. If you ask me, like, well, this successful projects, like, is not the result of only landscape architects' efforts. It necessarily need to involve people yeah. from different expertise. And so, that's the other huge yeah. lesson.
Successful teamwork.
Exactly.
Or successful collaboration, successful cooperation.
Exactly. Bring people who know more than you.
Yeah.
Always.
Yes. Yes. I completely get that. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. I love you've lived in different places. You've got so much experience and you bring so much to the profession by your background. It's really cool to hear about how you approach projects and how you've got that. You've almost got like a superpower, which is this, you know, approach to having that kind of product design mindset, but bringing landscape architecture into it. And I think it sounds like you collaborate well on lots of projects by appreciating the larger team when you're working. What is one thing that landscape architects and the profession can do right now to help combat the climate disaster?
Yeah, one of the things I always think about is how important it is to collaborate
yes.
with all the professions.
Yes.
And how important it is to surround yourself with people that know more than you and have, if possible, a different expertise.
Right.
In my case, I was always happy to bring something else on board and, yeah, someone will contribute in a different way. So as many professions you have in a project, the better it will be.
And if you could put a bench in one spot in the world, where would it be and why?
I would say, well, there's so many places that deserve a minute of contemplation. I would probably think of designing my own portable stool
uh-huh.
I could take with me
like
everywhere.
That. Yes! That's perfect! You'd have it on your backpack.
Exactly.
You'd see a great view.
Unfold
it. And you'd unfold it and enjoy.
That's what I would do.
That is a brilliant answer. Oh, thank you so much, Maria. Thank you.
Thank you.